Now I wanted to introduce our speaker. The topic is Finding Happiness and Tranquility in the Concrete Jungle here in Hong Kong, which I know has, the topic itself has led many of us to come today. And he's going to speak to us on how even busy and time-starved Hong Kong professionals can find peace of mind in this chaos. And our speaker is Anjan Brahm. And one thing he just told me about happiness, we were talking about him and how, his work he does, and we'll get all into that. We'll hear from him and we can ask him some questions about that. But one thing, I asked him for a quick tip and he said, well, as a monk, he sleeps on the floor, so you cannot get up on the wrong side of the bed. So so there's one tip. I'm not sure I'm gonna do that, but but it's a good tip. So our speaker was born in London and a graduate of Emmanuel College in Cambridge, where he studied theoretical physics. He is a Buddhist scholar, a meditator, and a theoretical physicist. Anjan Brahm is an abbot of Bodhayana Monastery in Australia and the spiritual advisor there and to their international foundation in Hong Kong. Theravada Buddhist monk for over 40 years. He's given talks at Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, and the UN, as well as to many other organizations. He's a prolific author with his publications translated to 24 languages, and they include books Opening the Door of Your Heart, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, The Art of Disappearing, and some of his books are here. We will have, he will speak for a while, and then we will have question and answer afterwards. So it is my pleasure, and the FCC's pleasure, to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Jody. And to talk about being happy in Hong Kong, this is, how many times have I been to Hong Kong now? It's about 10 times already. So it's so happy times, so happy memories here. I don't even remember how many times I've been here. But I do recall when I was a young man growing up in London, a very, very busy city, a concrete jungle certainly. But whenever I got tired working, I'd always find my little sanctuaries in the city. And one of those sanctuaries used to be a Westminster Cathedral. And I remember going in there whenever I was tired, just to sit down and be quiet and just be left alone so that I could recover my energies. And just before I left London to go to Thailand, where I was a monk for 9 years, that they'd installed a PA system. And they destroyed the sanctity of that great space. And even now, sometimes to go into a church, they call it a place of worship. I call it a place of silence, a stillness where we can actually recover one's senses and energy. And I'm not quite sure over here in Hong Kong how many places you can find, places of quiet and tranquility. If you can't find those places outside, you can always find those places in a special sanctuary you will find in every workplace, which is called the rest room. There is a reason it's called a rest room. It's not called an evacuation closet. It's called a rest room. So if you can't find any other place just to relax and find some peace, at least you can go to the rest room. And it doesn't matter how long you stay there for. If your boss says, why are you spending so much time in the restroom? You can say with honesty, because boss, I'm constipated. Not down here, but up here. I need to relax and let go. But that, if you can be have initiative to find some peace within and tranquility within sort of Hong Kong, number one, it will increase your happiness. It will increase your productivity. There's many studies have been done. And one of those studies at Harvard Business School, how to be productive and keep your happiness. Because as you say, you want everything. Now, I'm not sure if I said this last time, but I need your help. May I borrow your cup of water? I'll give it back to you. How heavy is this glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm starts to ache. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 3 minutes, I'm in agony and a very stupid monk. What should I do when this gets too heavy to hold comfortably? Put it down, let it go. Relax and rest. And then afterwards, you can pick it up again afterwards. It feels lighter. You can try this for yourself if you like. Thank you so much. Now, you see that is taught in Harvard Business School. Simply because it works. It's called an investment in time. Half an hour of relaxing means you get more work done in the afternoon. 3 hours work done in two. Why? It's because you are now creative and productive. This is not just learning to just goof off, do nothing, and get sacked from your job. You become far more productive and still keep your happiness. It's not a way of working longer hours, but even less hours, more efficiently, more productive, which means your happiness level goes up. One of the biggest problems in Hong Kong, many places in the world, that we get so tired. One of the biggest diseases of our world is tiredness, exhaustion. When I was teaching some young people, 15 to 25-year-olds in Kuala Lumpur, and talking about what's the emotion they suffer from most in today's world, it was tiredness. That tiredness, that exhaustion, stops us learning how to be happy, stops us being productive, stops us being healthy. This is not sort of a zero sum, this is win-win. You can both be happy and productive, successful in your work, in your business, but still with happiness. So first of all, we change our attitudes. If you want to be successful in life, you don't have to work that long hours. You have to work smart, be productive, rather be creative, rather than just keep on working, 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 working. Those of you who are journalists, writers, how hard is it to create sort of a piece of work, a passage? How many of you, the words just don't come up? You just, the sentence, the paragraph doesn't flow. You're not in the zone because you're exhausted and tired. That is one of the reasons why we push, 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 we get tired, we get depressed. Now, this is all about learning to see things in a different way. I will now, because this is the year of the dog, and we are in Hong Kong, I will now invoke some wisdom from one of the greatest American philosophers, Snoopy. As you know, Snoopy from Peanuts, the great friend of Charlie Brown. Snoopy and Charlie Brown were once sitting down, contemplating life. And Charlie Brown comes along and says, "You know, Snoopy, one day we will all die. Can you argue with that?" "Yes, you can." That was human wisdom. Dog wisdom far exceeds that of the human being. Because the dog said, Snoopy said, "Yeah, it's true that one day we'll all die, but most days we don't die." Now that is a positive attitude. That's looking at things in a totally different way, which means that we can have much more richness and happiness in life. And anyway, the whole idea of being successful in life. What is success? I was always told that you have to get some money and be well-known, be well-respected, have a nice family, and then you'll be happy. Work hard. And that drove my life. Pass your O-levels, then you'll be happy. Get your A-levels, and then you'll be really set. Go to a good university, get a degree from somewhere like Cambridge, then you'll be happy. That was a lot of BS. You know what BS means? It's bullshit, but I'm not allowed to say that word. How many people do you know are really happy? So then what happened? I I started reading some psychology, and they said, no, be happy first, and then you'll be successful. That's another bit of BS. Until you realize that happiness is success. Not happiness leads to success, or success leads to happiness. Happiness is success. So are you happy right now? Well done. You're successful. You've made it, baby. You've made it. But what that really means, it starts to look outside the box, see things in a different way. And that is perhaps one of the meanings of my life. You know, you take theoretical physics, which is really bending your perceptions of reality, take it even further and bend your perceptions of what happiness and success is. And Hong Kong, is it really busy? Of course it's not. You make it busy. There is something which I've noticed, it's called the in-between moments of your life. You are waiting at the doctor's surgery, you're waiting for the train to arrive, you're waiting in the lounge, waiting for your aircraft to take off. You have all these incredible moments. We've left where we came from, we haven't arrived at our destination, have these beautiful in-between moments of life. Those are the moments which we can grab, take on for our happiness in life. You don't always need to be thinking and worrying about what's going to happen in the future. As again, invoking Snoopy again, the great American the great American philosopher and dog, who said that worrying about the future does not stop bad things happening. It just stops you enjoying the good things occurring now. So the point is that as a human race, just we do need to tune up our brain. And so we can recognize happiness. We can find more time. Time is there, but we don't grab onto it, recognize it, value it. And if you could do that, it's possible. I know some of you might say, what does this fellow know about hard work? You may think that I'm a monk, I've left the world, I don't do much in my life. But I remember just fielding a criticism like that in a big talk in Singapore. And they said, what do you know about this, Ajahn Brahm? You're a monk, you don't live in the real world. And then I gave a description of what I was doing that day. Usually get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. This morning it was at 3 o'clock. I'll just get used to that. Doing some work, sometimes teaching all day. I gave a rundown of what a monk does. And it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock when this question, in the evening. And when I went through everything which I'd done that day, this gentleman got back to the microphone and said, wow, I never realized how hard a modern monk has to work. I always wanted to become a monk one day, but not now. But it doesn't matter how much you work or how many hours you put in. It's just your relationship to that work. To give you an idea of what I mean, the life is all about relationships. It's not about Hong Kong. It's not about you. It's what happens between us. The friendship, what we put between us and our work. One of my jobs is to do marriage blessings. Do a lot of marriage blessings. And quite often, I look the bride in the eye after the rings have been exchanged. And I tell her, you are now a married woman. You must never ever think of yourself from this day on. She nods. And then I look at the guy, say the same. You're a married man now. You must not think of yourself. Now this is anecdote, but it so happens so often. I don't know what it is about guys. I'm a guy, okay, so they always pause and think about it for a while. But then eventually, okay, I won't think of myself from now on. It's true. And then, still looking at the guy, said, now you're a married man, you must not think of her anymore, your wife. And I look at the wife and say, now you must not think of him anymore. And this is where we get wisdom from. It's like doing a crossword puzzle. a riddle, finding the answer. And the answer's a really good one. He said, from now on, you mustn't think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. From now on, you must only think of us. The relationship is between you. It's not about me. If it's about me, it's selfishness. It's not a marriage. If it's about her or him, your partner, you get burnt out. There's nothing in it for you. It's all about us, the relationship. So that is one of the great secrets of happiness. It's not about Hong Kong. It's not about your work, what you do. It's the relationship you have with your job. And that relationship is where you can change things, where you can improve things. You can't change your husband. You can't change your wife. What you can change is what's between you. This is where we find the secret of happiness. It's not about your job. It's about how you regard your job. As I was saying earlier, that I was a month ago doing a little seminar with business leaders in Hong Kong. No, sorry, in Singapore. And in those business leaders, speaking with Jason Goh, he is the CEO of Changi Airport Group. And he was telling me, we actually did a little interaction with the audience. How many people, when you go to work, resolve that I'm going to make somebody else happy today? No one put their hand up. How many people expect someone to make you happy at work today? Do you see the problem? We expect to find happiness. We don't give happiness. So he said, why don't you make a resolution when you go to work? I'm going to make someone happy today. I don't mean by resigning. I mean, you're just going to be kind, give a smile, whatever. And then it's not what you expect from your workplace. It's not what you feel you're entitled to. It's what you actually give. The relationship you have to your work, your job, you give happiness. And it's wonderful what you can do in a busy place, Hong Kong, London, wherever you are in this world. It's amazing just what you can do, just with a smile, with a, how are you feeling today? Would you like a cup of coffee? Doing something kind. It doesn't cost much at all, second, minute at most, and it's amazing just the result of that. You get happier and you bring happiness. The other thing is play. Play around. Sometimes people are just so damn serious. Way too serious. Even like as a monk, people get really surprised. A monk tells jokes. I will tell you one of my monk jokes from my father. He used to come and said, it's a bit on the edge, but here we go. What fun does a monk have? What fun does a monk have? The answer is none. Okay, come on. It's not true, by the way. It's just a joke. Okay. It's a bit of fun. So this is like pushing little boundaries a little bit to create a bit of happiness and laughter, which is great for your health, great for your happiness, and is always something which you can do in your life. It doesn't really matter where you live in life. It doesn't matter who you're living with. What you make of that, that is how you're happy. It doesn't matter about health problems. How many people with health problems get depressed? Why? Too much complaining. I would learn a long time ago, instead of thinking about your job, just do it. This talk was sponsored by Nike. Just do it. No, it wasn't. Am I making that up? But you know, a lot of times we worry, we think, oh, this is going to be difficult, this is going to be tough, and we find out it's not tough at all. So in life, just do it. And be a little bit on the edge. Just push boundaries a tiny bit, especially in journalism. Because if you don't adapt, you know, you die. You have to grow, you have to move, you have to experiment. And of course, never ever be afraid of making mistakes. Mistakes are funny. Every time I make a mistake, say the wrong word, do the wrong thing, I tell everybody about it. It means that you create happiness in our world. So, I've gone on for my 20 minutes. So now I will take any questions, criticisms and complaints, the three C's.
We are going to open this up to questions, and I will kind of moderate the questions. If you could say your name and your organization before you ask your question, and we have time for about 20 minutes worth of questions, so we hope there'll be some good ones. Who would like to start? Okay, I will start.
Okay, very good.
I'll get it going. You and I were talking a little bit before your talk about health and how you've been doing some work with hospitals and health organizations and have found that a lot of the visualization and changing your mind about some of your how you're feeling can have remarkable health effects. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Okay. In a background, theoretical physics, one of my best friends, close student of Stephen Hawking's, one of his closer disciples, that he was in the movie, The Theory of Everything. He was featured in that, Bernard Carr. He was a good friend. We used to go to not just physics lectures, but also to psychic research. We were pushing boundaries. We were hunted ghosts together. We wanted to find out, you know, the boundaries of knowledge and push them further. So one of the things we always would do would have a hypnotist come every year. And, you know, I tried to be hypnotized, but maybe too naughty to be hypnotized, to not following orders. So anyway, that one fellow was hypnotized, and it was a little experiment which stayed with me for a long time, because you saw this with your own eyes. There was a 4-inch nail on the end of a piece of wood. They hypnotized this young student to believe it was red hot. It was room temperature. But when they touched it on this little student's skin, he screamed in pain, which I could imagine, because, you know, they'd hypnotized him to believe it was red hot. What I never imagined to see was a blister come up on his hand. He was wounded. And this was not imagination. When he was taken out of hypnosis, the wound was still there. And that taught me a lot, that the mind was actually creating something on the body. There was no other reason for that wound. That nail was not red hot at all, but it actually created damage to the skin. Now, if the mind can create damage, can it also create healing as well? And of course, you know, that a lot of the times by doing, I spent my whole time training my mind. You know, before I was a monk, 43 years, it's been a long time just realizing the power of this thing we call the mind. This is actually where, this is a great avenue which has not been explored yet of how we can increase human health at very little cost. And of course, everywhere in the world, the governments are struggling with their health budgets. And it's something which is getting harder and harder to provide the health cover for everybody who needs it, deserves it. I was brought up in UK. If you were sick, you went to hospital. You weren't even thinking about how much it costs. It was a National Health Service. But even they are struggling now to actually to pay for this. How can we solve that problem? Good health, low cost. Already John Kabat-Zinn is doing something with mindfulness training, but that's the tip of the iceberg. There's much more we can do on that. That's one area I'm passionate about. You know these things work. I'm not some crazy guy. That, you know, I got my cred in theoretical physics, very hard logic. Why can't we actually use science, mind-based science, to actually do something? So that's going to happen. It has to happen because of the economic imperative. That is going to be most important. So there's a question over there.
Yeah, in the corner.
Hi, my name is Divya. I'm asking from a personal rather than professional perspective, what would you say is the best way of dealing, it's quite a wide question, wide remit, but what would you say is the best way of dealing with grief, particularly when you lose someone very close to you?
Okay, I was 16 when my father died. I never cried. I never felt sad. Even I loved my father to bits. When he died, I went to the funeral. I felt peaceful, but I could not understand my emotions. Many years later, I discovered how I was feeling by getting much closer to my emotional world. And I recognized it was so similar to another emotion which I felt growing up. I loved music, all types of music, grew up in London, and I was at the Marquee Club in Wardour Street, Soho, for the very first concert of Led Zeppelin. I remember going to a pub in North London. A band was playing, only six people turned up to watch. I thought the band would not play. The lead singer was someone called Rod Stewart. This was in the 60s and 70s in London. Great for listening to music. And when the music had ended, we'd all stand up, shout for more, the encore. And after five more minutes of playing, then the band had to go home, and so did I. And I knew that it was almost impossible to hear such great music again. But when I went out of those concert halls or pubs, I never cried at the end of a performance. I thought how lucky I was to have been there at the time. What great music that was. And I'll never forget it. And that's how I thought when my father died. 16 years, it's not long. He came close to dying many times, there were many encores. But when he died, I never felt it was a loss. I felt it was a gain. I've known that man for 16 years. And he would never be taken away. I remember him today, that joke I just said. And that's where I got my bad sense of humor from. Blame my dad, it's in my genes. So, that is how to deal with grief. You haven't lost anything. You've gained that person. Yeah.
My name is Charles Rickson, again, a personal question. I noticed that the UAE has appointed a Minister of Happiness. I don't know if you noticed that in the last year or so. Do you think more governments should appoint a Minister of Happiness? And then what should they do?
No, I don't think they should have a Minister of Happiness. I do remember the Minister of City Walks, anyone who used to watch Monty Python. No, because with happiness, are you always happy, sir? You know, trying to be happy just makes you so miserable. Everyone else is happy, but I'm not. And that really sucks. So that when I was teaching some years ago, it was a Indonesian young girl got really fed up. Said, why do I have to be happy? That going around seeing everybody smiling, and if I don't smile in the office, then I get the sack because I'm not following company policy. You must be happy when you greet your customers. And sometimes I get really fed up with my customers. I really like to go. But anyway, trying to be happy is what makes you suffer. So instead, you look at one of the books over there. It's called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And I gave this lady a grumpy license. She was my disciple, she respected me, she followed me, and I gave her this license written in Gothic script saying this license grants to this person permission to be miserable for any reason or no reason whatsoever for the rest of her life, signed your teacher. And I gave it to her. You wouldn't believe how popular those grumpy licenses became. Because people think, I've got to be happy. I've got to be rich. I've got to be healthy. There must be something wrong with me that I'm miserable. I'm not fitting in. That is the cause for people not being happy. So if you feel miserable, have a miserable day once a week. Instead of being miserable, we should have a minister for misery. In other words, Just, you know, accept it. Sometimes you're in a bad mood. So stop trying to be something you're not.
Yes, right here.
I'm a Chinese doctor. Yeah. I was just wondering, with the power of the mind, how much do you think that can help with cancer?
100%. That's a really strong claim. But I've seen that. I've been working with cancer people, and I'm not going to call them cancer sufferers. Don't stigmatize things. Cancer people with over 30 years and just well respected by the community. That's why they keep coming to see me. I went to the big opening of this multi-million dollar campus they built in Perth. So much of that cancer is an overreaction of the body to stress. The mind can do things. If you worry about things, if it's negative, like the head of the cancer council over in Perth, twice he's asked me this question, knowing the answer, just wanted everyone else to hear it. So, should you fight cancer? No. It's the fighting of it, doing battle, that violence to your body. That is one of the reasons why the cancer came in the first place. You change your attitudes to life. Stop fighting. And especially as, you know, people reminded me of that lady from Hong Kong, Anita. I always find trouble pronouncing her name, Murujali, or whatever her name was. Murujali. You know, her dying to live, where, you know, she, so close to death, and she came to the realization afterwards that the reason she had that cancer in the first place was trying to live up and meet other people's expectations. That pushing herself, she was so successful, so happy on the outside, but inside it was such a struggle meeting other people's expectations. You've all seen me for the last 20, 25 minutes. And those of you who've seen me for the first time will probably understand I do not meet your expectations of a Buddhist monk. And I refuse to. And so you can, you know that that pressure is. No, just, I shouldn't have gone off the subject, but this is an important point that somebody was noticing, a psychologist I agree with immensely, that suicides, many people who are suicide are perfectionists. They seem successful, happy, well-balanced, doing well in life, but because they're perfectionists, you can never reach the level where you think you should be. Other people think you're doing well in life, but you think you should do better. And there's no end to that. To the point that you despair. That's why there's a wonderful answer to why many people I've known, families, suicide victims, they look successful, happy. Why are they committing suicide? Or, I shouldn't say committing suicide, suiciding. Because they're trying too hard. Trying to live up to other people's expectations, or their expectations. Being perfectionist. That's why a happiness officer will just raise your expectations up again.
So I disagree at some level, because I think what happens is we associate happiness with this hedonistic approach that we all have. I think the governments do have a role to play. But the thing is, in Hong Kong, when you go out, there are all these hoardings telling you, you buy me, and I'll make you happier. But no one, we all know that things and money does not make us happy. So who will shed light on stuff that you are teaching us? Yeah. You cannot come every time and tell us that, oh, this, live your emotions, be miserable, be happy, right? So who is there to teach us? The schools don't teach us, colleges don't teach us. Where do we get this information? We are very lucky that we are listening to you. Not everybody is as fortunate. So I think we have to have, we have to shift the focus of what happiness really means.
Good. Okay, I agree with you there. So one of the things which obviously means is that don't try too hard and you will achieve more. It sounds counterintuitive, but to put it into a visual perspective, there was a woman who's quite depressed, anxious. She came to see me and she said, you know, in a visual metaphor, this is where I am, this is where I know I should be. It's just so hard to move myself up, to know where I should be. And that's so much stress. And of course the answer was obvious. This is where you are, and this is where you think you should be. Instead of moving where you are to think where you should be, how about moving where you should be to where you are? Problem solved. But he said, that's not progressing in life. It is progression. Because when you move yourself to where you are, you know, you're here, you have innovation, you have creativity, that's where you get your successful. The happiness of being now, and you do grow enormously with help. The reason I said you shouldn't have a happiness officer, or rather minister of happiness, is because then they'll put a tax on happiness and they will fine you if you're not happy enough. Or something like that. Minister of Loneliness. Okay. Has he got any staff? He should be on his own. Walk his talk. Don't be a hypocrite.
Are there questions? Yes. Here.
Who's the next one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Right.
Hi, I'm Julia Charlton. I'm a lawyer. I would like to hear... Thank you very much for your wonderful talk. It's very inspiring. I'd like to hear your thoughts, please, on your view on the relationship between Christianity and Buddhism.
Christianity and Buddhism. Look, it just, I have a lot of friends who are Christians. And one of the things I really made sure of when I became a Buddhist was not just to associate with other Buddhists. Actually, to get feedback, criticism, and get the best, you know, from all spiritualities. These days, a lot of times, especially in Western countries, we don't talk about religion anymore. Spirituality. If it's real religion, real spirituality, can't we have love between all beings? It says, love thy neighbor as thyself. These are neighbors. So why can't we enjoy each other's company? Learn from one another. So my job is to take away barriers. So when I was at a conference with, there was a Christian intellectual. He was so well known that the Australian government asked him to head a panel to introduce a Bill of Human Rights into the Australian Constitution, Father Frank Brennan. So he asked me this question. What is the Buddhist concept of God? And this is how I answered it. Because I had a friend, he was another abbot, a Benedictine abbot. So my friend, the Benedictine abbot, has been telling me through all our discussions that one of his fundamental beliefs is that everyone is searching for God. Now, don't react to that. If you're an atheist, a Buddhist, or whatever, don't react. Respect people. So I said, this is my friend. I respect him. Now, how can I use that to answer your question? I said, what are each one in this room searching for? For happiness? No, for love? No, to be able to give love to another being and to receive love back? For respect? For peace, for meaning in life. And that was an answer which everybody could agree with, whether you're an atheist, a Buddhist, a Muslim. What are you searching for? Why are you coming here for? Why are you living? These are the things we're all searching for. So I said, well, if my friend says everyone is searching for God, and this is what all my friends are searching for, who are Buddhist, atheist, whatever, that must mean what God is. Peace. Respect, the ability to love and be loved, ability to care, find some meaning, find some happiness. When people ask me what the meaning of life is, it's the meaning you give to life. Instead of feeling entitled and feel like life is going to give you meaning, you put meaning into your life. So when I said that, that he said, wow, it's very good. Because that was an answer which didn't create walls between communities, and which would take the understanding of spirituality to a deeper level. So that is the connection between Buddhism and Christianity. Does that make sense? You got a answer back, yeah? Okay. We want to rejoin her?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, that was wonderful. What I thought you might say was there was no conflict, and that a Buddhist could, you could be a Christian and a Buddhist.
Yeah, we call that, every 25th of December, teacher of in Thailand realized, well, what are you doing this Christmas for? So they called it Quit Buddhamas. There's a couple of Thai people here, you know, that Quit Buddhamas. Why not? Celebrate the good in everything.
Right over here.
Yeah, hi, my name's Elisa Hofer-Monser. I just forgot it there for a second. I'm studying psychology at the moment, but I'm just wondering about happiness, joy, contentment. Differences, are they the same?
It's wonderful when we don't use words and confine them into just like a God or like love or kindness. Do you need to give them a dictionary definition? Or is that limiting it? So what happiness, what love? Love and laughter. Sometimes they sound so close together that I'm not an etymologist. I was going to say entomologist. That's about ants. etymologist. But there must be some connection there. Because, you know, if you love someone, you have a wonderful time together. It's so easy to laugh. To be alive. As I mentioned in the talk last night, the only people I've known who don't laugh are dead people. Well, I do lots of funerals and I tell jokes I never hear.
We have time for another two questions. Are there other? Yes, right here.
There's one over there as well. And on the end. Make it three.
Since you mentioned psychology a few times, I thought I'll ask the question. My name is Dr. Florence Huang. I'm a psychologist and a professor. You talked about the pursuit of happiness, and I think a lot of times when we talk to our clients, it's about the purpose and meaning in life. But what is your perspective in terms of the negative emotion, and what is the role of negative emotion in the pursuit of happiness?
It's negative emotion. It gives you something to work with. For example, just a quick simile, it's like you tread in the dog shit on your way home. What should you do? This is a simile for negativity which arises in your mind. You should always take that dog shit back with you to your house, to your home. Don't scrape it off your shoes. And dig it in the garden under an apple tree, and then 1 year later your apples will be sweeter than ever before. And you must always remember when you bite into that apple and the juice comes down your cheek, please remember what you are eating. You're eating dog shit, which has been transformed into juicy, sweet apple. So, I had apple crumble today, so I don't know where that came from, but that is where negative emotions come from. They are the fertilizer of wisdom and kindness. That's why it's not that something's wrong that you feel negative. That means you get depressed of being depressed. You've been sick of being sick. So this is actually the double whammy of overreacting with negativity to negativity. Okay, there's a question.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Kate and I'm a lawyer as well. I was just wondering, the principles, the teachings, learnings that we've heard about from you today, were these things that you were appreciated and put into practice before you became a monk? Was it becoming a monk that gave you the space, peace to be able to discover these? I guess the driver behind this question is, do we have to give things up in our lives to achieve what you've achieved?
No, it's not sort of a zero-sum game. As I say, it's win-win. But what is really good to do is to find that space in your life. Instead of when you have a holiday saying, where should I go? Why not stay in your apartment or your house? I always say there's no place like home. There's no bed, no pillow like the pillow you put your head on every night. Why go away? So we spend time in being with ourselves. Retreat, solitude, quietness. That is excellent no matter what job you have to do in life. As you are a lawyer, there's one lawyer some years ago in New York when there was a death penalty enforced. He was a criminal lawyer. He defended many people. If he said the wrong thing, made the wrong argument, they'd go to the electric chair. So high stress. And he decided he needed some space during the lunch hour. No place to really go to, so he cleaned out a cupboard in his office. And every day, lunch hour, his secretary locks him in the cupboard for half an hour. If he doesn't go into his cupboard, it's a pain in the ass in the afternoon. So he locks him in his cupboard. Any calls come, sorry, he's in his cupboard. He's a far more efficient lawyer because of that cupboard. So in your office, please get a cupboard and get someone to lock you in there. It's win-win. Can the last one?
One more question. Yeah. Who has a final question? Oh, over here. Yeah. Great.
Oh, sorry.
Darren Fitzgerald, sorry, another lawyer. You may have already answered my question, though. I'm a lawyer which deals in disputes day in, day out. So my question for you is, when you can't avoid conflict, tips for dealing with that?
Yeah, it's when you can't afford conflict, conflict is also a part of life. Is, again, if you can call time out. In time out, people have a chance to reflect. You know, they give that chance, you know, to lower their anger and just to see something which they can't see when the enemy is right in front of them. That time out is really, really important. So if you can have a time out room somewhere in your chambers or something, and just quietness, peace, and I'll come back tomorrow, and don't even call, don't do anything. And I think that is quite helpful, because then you can see outside the box, do things differently. Did I tell you the last time about the two people arguing over the orange? This classic conflict management is the two people arguing over an orange. There's only one orange in the kitchen. And one said, well, you had the last one. Yeah, but you had the last two. You promised me this one and the one before. And so the only thing they could do is have a compromise. They cut the orange in half. And one of the parties peeled the orange, threw the peel in the trash can, and ate the flesh. The other one peeled their half of the orange, threw the flesh into the trash can because they needed the peel to make some marmalade. If they've only found out what they want, it can always be a win-win situation in conflict. But sometimes it's changing perspectives, and we can win much more. Okay, so thank you for listening.
Excitement.
I wonder what this is.